So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe, and joining me as guest co-host today is Senior Editor Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Well, sort of. Well, this week has been kind of a crazy week in tech news.
To say the least.
I feel like things are shifting under us as we speak. Clearly, this week we're going to have to talk about the fact that Elon Musk sort of owns Twitter now. I say sort of because I feel like there's still regulatory approval that's going to happen.
They're still waiting for the, you know, approvals, the deal to close, which probably won't happen until sometime later this year. But yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. We've got couple of guests coming to join us to talk about this episode. And we're also going to talk about some other stuff like the Android 13 beta that dropped this week, as well as some other Google prototype news. As always, if you're enjoying the show, make sure you subscribe to us on your podcast catcher of choice. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes. And if you have time, you can come join us every Thursday morning at about 10 a.m. Eastern. We're usually live streaming the behind-the-scenes recording of this show on the Engadget YouTube channel. And starting today, also on the Engadget TikTok account. So if that's more your speed, head on over there Thursdays at about 10 a.m. Eastern. So this week's been kind of crazy if you follow either Twitter or Elon Musk. And basically, Twitter accepted Elon Musk's offer to buy it for about $44 billion. Here to break the news down with and for us are Engadget's own senior editor, Carissa Bell. Hey, Carissa.
Hello, hello.
Hey, and we also have a special guest, tech editor at Yahoo Finance, Dan Howley. Hey, Dan, how's it going?
Hey, what's happening?
All right, so I'm going to start off by asking Carissa to kind of just guide us to this point. Like, how did we get here?
I think we're all wondering that to some extent. if you remember, Elon Musk had, you know, made this offer that, you know, sounded very outlandish.
Yeah.
You know, a few weeks ago, that he wanted to buy Twitter for $54.20 a share. You know, before that, he had been acquiring shares and became one of the largest stakeholders of the company. So the board had said, you know, they were considering his offer. And then this week, they said that they were accepting it and that they were going private.
So they're going private. And I think there's a lot of question about where Elon Musk is getting this money, right? $44 billion is no chump change for anyone. I think there were like some rumblings of where he might be getting that money. Carissa, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, he used his Tesla stock, and then he got, you know, he got two different kinds of financing from a couple different banks that, you know, put up a majority of the money.
Dan, do you know what the risk is associated with something like this for Tesla to be doing, for Elon to be doing this sort of share-backed loan?
Yeah, I mean, look, if I think the overall is that if Tesla shares do fall, past a certain amount, you know, he's not going to be able to finance it the way that he wants to. And so that would just throw this entire thing out the window. And, you know, Tesla shares have been sliding as a result of this, you know, well, as a result of innumerable factors, right? Just because it's the stock market. You can't really point to one thing, but, you know, the overarching message seems to be that, you know, he only has so much time. He's only one person. And he's got Tesla, SpaceX, the Boring Company, Neuralink, and now this. And he seems to spend a lot of time tweeting like he's been doing regularly. So I think people are nervous about whether or not he'll be able to keep up the promises that Tesla has made, namely ramping up their production rate. I think it's 500,000 vehicles a year. And, you know, I mean, they're going to be kind of on their back feet just because of this.
Right.
And I think that's where a lot of the fear comes from. And that's why we're starting to see that stock slide.
I mean, look, Carissa, Carissa recently wrote for us a piece about how Elon Musk's bid for Twitter is as well thought out as his tweets. I just thought that was amazing as a headline. I don't know if you saw that, Dan, but do you agree? Like, this didn't seem like he really spent that much time thinking.
Yeah, that's an incredible headline, by the way. I mean, look, you know, he does tweet. He did a TED Talk, I think, last Friday or the Friday prior, basically saying that he tweets from the toilet. Like,
cool, just, me too, you know, but
yeah. So, but you have to think, like, you know, this man is the richest person on earth. You know, he's in this like back and forth argument with the other richest person on earth, Jeff Bezos, about, you know, who's able to land, put a lander on the moon. And there's lawsuits going on there, or there were lawsuits going on over there.
Yeah.
You know, it just feels like he took this idea about trying to take over Twitter. And yeah, just didn't really put too much thought behind how he's going to monetize it further, how he's going to grow its user base. I mean, his whole thing seems to be, he doesn't like the fact that people can tell him what he can and can't say on a platform. And he had like this, you know, argument, I guess, with Twitter, I guess, at large. And so now he just said, well, I'm not going to take my ball and go home. I'm just going to buy the whole basketball court, and you guys are going to have to play by my rules now. So, you know, it really does feel like that's just where this came from. He said he's said it's not about the revenue. That's crazy. You know, I mean, this is a company that's supposed to be worth billions.
Yeah.
The stock was trading at much higher than $54.20 a share last year. And, you know, he's buying it at what is more or less a discount from what it was in 2021. So, you know, it really is, it doesn't feel like he's put too much thought into this. And, you know, there's rumblings that it may not even go through at all.
I mean, I want to get to that in a little bit. And I also have something to ask Carissa after this. But Sam, I saw you had like kind of a reaction. I don't know if you wanted to say something.
Like you said, like Elon says, like, it's not about the money. And I actually kind of believe him, because like, you're right. Like, this is like, he has like picking this weird, like, fight in principle against like what he thinks censorship should be on the internet. And he's like, well, I'm going to buy Twitter, and I'm going to show you how free speech should be instituted online. And that's like a really like wild thing to say, because it's like, oh, you know, he's going to change like the way Twitter, you know, works on censorship, you know, because like there was those, you know, Twitter removed some links to some posts last year, and like, you know, then they had to kind of backtrack, and it's all very nebulous. And then there's some other like more far out things. It's like, he wants to authenticate all humans as part of Twitter. Like, what does that mean? And like, you know,
give everyone a blue check mark. That's what he means.
Right. And I think there's like, he, in his head, he kind of thinks that like, there's something about the ability for people to be anonymous on Twitter that like, oh, you know, anonymous bots are like really a big issue. And, you know, there's, you know, he wants to, you know, increase, you know, accountability, which is like, but, you know, even people say a lot of crazy stuff on Twitter now, and there's no accountability. So I don't know how he's going to fix that issue. So I don't know. It all seems very strange to me. And then even going back a little bit, like Elon is putting apparently $21 billion of his own cash on the line on top of the other financing and the other debt arrangements, which is like, okay. It must be fun to have that much play money to just like throw around like that. But it's like, and at some point, like the numbers and the size of these deals, it's just like, it's just hard to think about.
I want to point out the free speech aspect. And it's interesting, because it's something, you know, just from covering Section 230 and talking to free speech experts, you know, it's interesting that there's this discussion on censorship, which is really, you know, it's the negative way to refer to content moderation, which is what it really
is. And I think he just had a tweet the other day talking about how Truth Social, which is Trump's like social media thing, wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Twitter's moderation policies, which is like an incredibly wild thing to say. And it's like, that I'm not sure makes a lot of sense, but I mean, yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, the big thing is, if he was truly a free speech advocate, then he would be in favor of what Twitter's doing, because Twitter is using its own form of free speech to allow what it wants on its site. And that's completely within the bounds of the law. And you know, Section 230, you know, the big boogeyman, I guess, you know, whether it can be reformed or not, or needs reform or not, is for another discussion. But under that, it isn't a law that protects, you know, companies. It protects companies from frivolous lawsuits that would be thrown out because of the First Amendment to begin with. So it's doing exactly what it's meant to do. Twitter is doing exactly what it should do as a company that wants to use its free speech rights. He just doesn't agree with their version of free speech. And, you know, I think that's something that is part of a larger discussion and points to kind of this idea that he doesn't really know what he's going to do with this or why, because he's fighting free speech. He's fighting against free speech for free speech.
He's using money to change free speech, which is like, yeah,
very weird. But I want to get back to Carissa for a second, because look, you also wrote a piece called "No One Knows What the Heck is Going to Happen After Elon Buys Twitter." And that's exactly what Dan is saying. Like, he doesn't seem to even know. But you also recently, maybe not this week, but last, wrote about Jack Dorsey's feelings on this issue. Can you tell us what Jack Dorsey said?
Yeah, I think that was kind of a surprise to some people, maybe, is that Jack Dorsey came out and was like very emphatic that he thought that Elon Musk buying Twitter was not only really good, but, like, you know, he said that he was going to be able to fix a lot of fundamental things that he didn't like. He said that Elon is the singular solution I trust to lead Twitter.
That is a quote.
You know, yeah, you know, Jack has done this thing lately where he, now that he's stepped back as CEO, and he's gotten, you know, full on his crypto and Web3 stuff. He's talked a lot about how he kind of regrets the role that he played in, like, centralizing these social platforms. And, he, you know, in these tweets, he said that he thought, you know, that Twitter shouldn't really be owned by anyone. And, you know, but because that Elon's going to, like, kind of save it from this, like, Wall Street ad model where they're just sort of, like, tied to metrics, and that, you know, he would help spread the global light of consciousness, and, you know, all these very kind of like characteristically like Jack Dorsey things to say. But, you know, it was kind of the first time that we've really heard much from him in terms of like his kind of thoughts on this. And then, of course, you know, Elon turned around and started assaulting a lot of Twitter employees. So, you know, I'm not sure how Dorsey's feeling now.
I just want to say it's interesting that every time someone who worked at Facebook or Twitter or, you know, any social media site, once they've made their billions or millions and billions of dollars and they can remove themselves from it, then they're apologetic. You know, oh, I feel bad that I did this, but I'll gladly take my millions and billions of dollars. Yeah. So I never buy that when they're like, oh, it shouldn't be owned by someone. Dude, you built this. You're the one who got rich off of it.
Yep.
Where was the outrage then?
And speaking of riches too, right? Like Sam was, I think, sort of getting at this point, which is that I the idea of taking something private, taking a business private to enforce free speech, and then the fact that no one but billionaires could be the ones with the power and resource to do something like this, to be so fed up with the platform that you're like, ah, screw it, I'm just going to buy this thing and do it the way I want. That's entitlement on a level that I can't even begin to think about. Are these people out of touch to the point where can they even understand what the average Joe user on Twitter wants to use? I mean, Carissa, I know that there's Twitter's earnings coming up later today as of this recording of the podcast. Do we expect any appearances, any statements, any controversy lined up?
Probably not, would be my guess. You know, they canceled their call. You know, everything that we've heard of, like, what's going on inside of Twitter right now, obviously there's, you know, people are very apprehensive about what's going on, but, you know, there was an all hands meeting this week and Twitter CEO got up and, you know, basically, yeah, Parag had to tell all the employees that, you know, we don't really know what's going on. The deal is expected to close, I think, in October. And, you know, after that, it's kind of whatever Elon wants. You know, they're like, we don't know what's going to go on with the platform. We're hoping that, you know, he might tell us, I guess. I think that there's just like a lot of uncertainty. You know, I think that there's some, you know, if you work at Twitter, you're probably very concerned about what happens to your, you know, your stock that you're granted, which is like a big part of how you're paid. You know, if you work at one of these companies, and then there's, you know, these big existential questions of like is he gonna like just get rid of all the content moderation rules? Is it something else? I mean, we just have no way of knowing, and, you know, a lot of people are speculating based on like things that Elon is saying, but until we actually see something more concrete, it's just really hard to know. Like I think I've told you before, I don't like trying to predict what Elon Musk is going to do.
No, there's no one's going to be able to do that, except even Elon Musk himself might not be able to predict what Elon Musk is going to do. I feel like is the sense we're getting. We also know that the EU, their internal market commissioner, has said publicly in an interview with the Financial Times that Elon Musk's Twitter will still be subject to EU regulations, and there are rules to follow, including just how they will moderate their content too, right? And we know that the EU has led the way in a lot of these things that protect like data privacy for consumers in general, and they have been effective in like widespread across the world and how websites actually, you know, talk about the cookies they use on their website, how they're tracking your data. But beyond that, I don't know that we've really seen a lot about what to expect next. I don't think anyone has a good sense. In fact, what are you, you guys, Dan and Carissa, I'll start with Dan. What do you think is going to happen next? Like where we are right now is we're waiting for what, SEC regulatory approval? Is that right?
Yeah. So we're still waiting for regulatory approval and shareholder approval. You know, that would be, you know, the end of it at that point. But, you know, to your point about regulation and the EU, we've seen politicians come out here in the US already say, it doesn't matter who owns it, it's still a massive network that still needs to follow certain guidelines. So, you know, I mean, Twitter has always been kind of had this outsized impact on the society and like the discourse. It's got 200 million plus, I forget what its most recent numbers were, users. Was it 229 million users as of its latest quarter? That's nothing compared to TikTok. That's nothing compared to Facebook itself, let alone Facebook's family of apps. I don't know what Pinterest is or Snap as far as their
That's size. A great point. I was actually like just kind of jumping in on what you're saying. It seems like Twitter has like an outsized influence on social media. And so just to kind of add new numbers, Pinterest, according to Statista, has 444 million monthly active users, which is more than Twitter. TikTok is about a billion, so way more than Twitter. Instagram is 1.5 billion, and Facebook is 2.9 billion. And it's like, and so everyone's like, I think part of it is because Twitter has like this air of credibility, which is kind of weird to say, but at least compared to like, you know, Facebook or Instagram, because it's like if a news, like some breaking news happens, you know, we like Engadget or CNN or New York Times, they're going to post that first on Twitter. They're not going to go to Instagram first and talk about, oh, the, you know, war in Ukraine has changed, you know, they're not going to use that Instagram for that. And so that's why, like, you know, people care so much about Twitter, even though it's not as popular as a lot of the other social media platforms.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's, you know, I think it has to do with less on how many people there are and more about who is on there, right? You know, you have these names, obviously Trump made it his de facto press secretary. We've seen, you know, Elon Musk, this is essentially his PR arm. Tesla doesn't have any PR really to speak of. They never did advertising. It's all word of mouth. So that's basically what he's done with this. Same thing with SpaceX and the Boring Company. You know, I think that we see all of these, you know, obviously journalists like ourselves are on it. So it kind of gets, I think, more of a boost than it does because of that than it would for the average person. And I think the other thing is when you use something like Twitter, you know, outside of, again, journalists or we're watching it for breaking news all the time. You know, in my spare time, I look at Twitter maybe once, but I'm on Instagram or TikTok for a long time, just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. So it's, you know, like user engagement is way lower, I think, than on something like a TikTok or an Instagram or, you know, Facebook. It just has this wild, wild outsized impact compared to its actual size.
I think that was like a question I was going to get to too, which is that like, I think we're in a small circle where we're media people, we're tech people, we're definitely going to be more on Twitter than, let's say, the average person on the internet, right? Most people, like you guys said, are on Instagram, Facebook more. But then I've also seen over the week since the announcement that Twitter was going to accept that bid, everyone's been like, oh no, I'm going to bounce, buy Twitter, I'm out. Or people have been complaining about losing followers because I guess the bots are just dying or people have been actually deactivating their accounts. And so there's that sort of sentiment going on here. Carissa, you also wrote about an open source alternative that's supposedly gaining in popularity since. Do you think that this will actually become a more mainstream option for people?
Or, no.
And right, I guess, but also...
Short answer.
Short answer. Long answer. Yeah, long answer. Are there other alternatives people might consider too?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are. Like, we are seeing, this happens anytime Twitter does something that's controversial, right? Like, it's happened when there's, you know, they change the character limit or they come out with some new feature, and then people get mad, and then they're like, I'm going to Mastodon, or I'm going to... You know, so one of these other services, like, I think, you know, the Mastodon is interesting because they are open source. They're, like, doing a lot of things that Jack Dorsey and Twitter has said that they would like to pursue, you know, where they're, like, this protocol and you can have different instances and you can take your followers with you. And so, like, I think that's interesting just from that perspective. I think it's also just a really niche platform that's not necessarily, like, that easy to use. So, like, I don't think this is, like, going to be what makes, like, Mastodon the next big thing. But, you know, I think the broader point that, like, it does, like, people, when people get unsettled, like, a lot of people, you know, they start looking at other platforms. We've also seen on the other side of it, like, Truth Social, like, Trump's social media app has been doing well, very, very well. You know, I think that was, like, the top social media app, you know, and it just kind of, and then, like, within Twitter itself, there's been a lot of reporting that, you know, sort of these, like, more mainstream or left-leaning accounts, I guess, have lost a lot of followers. While these sort of, you know, characters on the right, like, you know, the Trump Jr. or, you know, Ben Shapiro or, like, you know, some of these guys have gained a lot of followers. And I guess Twitter said that they think it's, you know, sort of organic, like people are deactivating and people are joining. You know, I think it's probably a little bit harder to understand, like, just when, you know, follower counts change for, like, a lot of different reasons. But it is interesting, like, and there is, you know, some people who are worried, like, maybe there's going to be, like, this influx of, you know, people who, I guess, maybe sympathize more with the far right and, you know, how that could affect the platform. So it's interesting. And Elon has said that he just wants to piss off the far left and the far right equally.
I mean, okay, good for him. I guess my last question, because we're kind of out of time, is for everyone, starting with Carissa. So are you going to quit Twitter?
I wish I could. But I'm unfortunately, we'll see what happens. If it becomes, you know, if it becomes like a, like, truly toxic dumpster fire, you know, I would, but I'm unfortunately very attached to my Twitter account.
How about you, Dan?
I'm in the same boat. I wish I could just leave it, you know, just get an, just abandon ship entirely. I want to get rid of all social media for myself. I despise it. You know, it's just a time sink. But I need it for work. I need to know what's going on. I have TweetDeck up right now, right?
How dare you not give us your full attention?
I'm not looking at it. It's
okay,
over here.
Okay.
But I, you know, I need that. I need to know what's going on with Instagram, if, you know, there's any major updates to it. So I have to be on these platforms, but I don't want to be. I don't want to feel like, you know, whenever I have a free second, you know, walking down the street, that I have to pull out my phone and look at, I don't know, some dumb video of someone falling down, or, you know, a golden retriever playing with ducks.
That's,
you know,
cute.
Very cute. Yeah. Very cute. But it's just such a time sink. And I mean, Twitter in particular is such it just feels like a wasteland. So if I could ditch it, I absolutely would.
Sam, I know you're not on Facebook. Would you?
I'm not going to quit Twitter, but I think it's because I don't, I'm not doom scrolling as much as, like, everyone else is. And so, like, I tweet maybe, like, once or twice a week, and I don't know if it's, like, just my personality or just, like, whatever it is. It's, like, I feel like I'm kind of immune to, like, social media. And so, like, I have an Instagram account. I haven't posted in a year, maybe 2 years. Basically, you know, to what Carissa and Dan were saying, it's, like, I still use Twitter, and mostly it's because I'm following people that, like, I need to pay attention to or I need to cover, or companies are announcing things. And so that's always going to be important. And maybe, you know, in 5-6 years, there will be a new competitor. But, like, you know, because I don't feel like that addiction to social media, it's not something I feel like I need to quit at the same time.
I mean, these are all good points. And it's clear that we are not going to know a lot about what's going to happen with Twitter until at least after an SEC regulatory approval on the buy. And then if Elon ever comes out and says things. So for now, I guess we're just continuing to keep an eye and maybe hold on to our Twitter accounts for a little bit longer. But anyway, I want to thank you guys, Carissa and Dan, for joining us today to go over all of this as it happens. Dan, thanks for joining us from Yahoo Finance. Where can people find you online?
You can find me at Daniel Howley on Twitter.
Yeah. That sign-off has a whole new meaning now, doesn't it?
No.
And then on Yahoo Finance, I'm usually posting regularly.
Gotcha. And Carissa, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter as well, Carissa B. Maybe soon on Mastodon. Who knows?
I would love to check out Mastodon after this. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And thank you for your time. So this week on about Tuesday, I want to say Google also released the Android 13 beta 1. This is the first like public beta before we were in like developer previews. And I think we were up to like DP developer preview 2 thereabouts. So this is really our first good look at some of the features coming to Android 13. I'm already spending some time testing it out. I can tell you a little bit more about what's new, what to expect. But Sam, does this public beta, at least from what you've heard so far, does it get you excited at all about Android 13?
Not really. I mean, I feel like Android is like, you know, a very like mature operating system like Windows or Mac OS or iOS. And so there's not as much big issues that Google has left to address. And I've been playing around with it for, you know, about a day. And, you know, I haven't really noticed that many changes. But you know, what do you think, Trillin? Like, are there any like features that like, oh, like this is, I'm like, I've been waiting for this for so long. I haven't really gotten that impression.
I have not. I will say though, there are surprisingly, like there were more, new tools in this beta than I had expected. I got the sense that this wasn't like the most, you know, user-facing beta. This was really for developers that might not be yet in the developer program for some reason or don't want to flash an image to their phones to start really getting their apps and their stuff compatible with this version of Android, because I think Google really should get a head start on some of the new features, and this is one way to do it. I will say there are some new tools, and shout out to our peers, I guess, at Android Police, who've been like eagle-eyed and digging through all of the beta stuff. So there's a new QR scanner. I don't know if you've seen that, Sam. It might be easy to miss. There's a QR code scanner embedded inside the quick settings panel now. You have to go all the way into the other options and look for it. So right now, the way QR scanning works for, I think, most people,
you just open up the camera app and point your foot camera, which, you know, kind of to your point, it's like, okay, I like that there's a QR like setting that's like not in the camera, but it's easier and faster for me to pull up the camera app.
So look, QR codes are like even more prevalent now thanks to the pandemic than they were before. Everyone's using it for like contactless menus, right? But and yes, I agree that it's faster to just open your camera. But the way QR code scanning works in the camera app right now, it's like you open the viewfinder, it's a live version of the QR code, you kind of like hover, and then when you sort of lock on to the QR code, this tiny little URL bar shows up, and you have to like keep your phone still sort of around the QR code and not have it move too much, and then like
you make it sound like you're juggling things. It's like, it's not that difficult.
I'm a clumsy, uncoordinated person. Okay. This is what is good. I drop my phone a lot. But this new QR code scanner, I mean, once you set it up to be like a shortcut in your quick settings panel, it's pretty easy to access. The second you tap it, it launches quick. It grabs onto like a QR code, like basically immediately. It's very fast. And then it stops being a viewfinder. It becomes an image of the QR code. So you no longer have to keep aiming. And then the target button for you to launch the website is much bigger. It's just like a better interface for QR code scanning. However, like we say, like, how much of an impact will this make on your life? How many QR codes are people scanning a day that this is going to make that much of a difference? I don't know.
Right. Well, and I think the other thing is that, like, people are have, like, Google has sort of already trained people to open up the camera app to find QR codes.
Right.
And so it's like, it really depends on the user to, like, how knowledgeable are they going to be about Android 13 in that, like, they even are aware that there's a new QR code feature, which, you know, that I think, like, and this is kind of like a symptom of, like, the tech world in general, is that there are so many new features constantly being added to the products that you already own that, like, yeah, you have to actively, like, seek out these features or else you're, like, you know, you might not use them at all, which is not a bad thing, but it's, like, you know, it puts some of the burden on, you know, the owner to be like, oh, there's a new software update, let me find out what's going on. And, I, you know, like, maybe it makes us feel more important because, like, we get to talk about it, but, like,
it's very much like a power user thing, right? Like, I think power users are going to be the ones, or the very big fans of tech and Android are going to be the ones reading this sort of stuff. And then they'll go around to, like, if parties happen again, they'll be like, oh yeah, did you know you could do this with your Android phone? Hey. And then, like, it's like you said, bragging rights almost.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me, I think my favorite new feature is the ability to control your smart home devices mm-hmm. from the lock screen. Because mm-hmm. I love smart lights. I, you know, my house is filled with smart lights. And so being able to, you know, say you don't want to use voice controls, like, you know, someone's watching a movie and you don't want to, like, mess up their time, but you do want to adjust the lighting, you know, it's easier. You don't have to unlock your phone. You can just do it right from the lock screen menu. And I think that's probably, for me, the biggest user-facing change. Because, like you said, there are a lot of, like, developer-oriented changes mm-hmm. that you might not notice if you were just going to load up the beta on your phone. You won't see these features just going around every day.
The smart home controls thing, I think the big change too is that, like, because on Android 12, I also have access to it from the home screen. It's from the lock screen. It's more that, like, now you supposedly don't have to sign in first to access your smart home controls.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it's definitely, like, less of a step. The other thing that I personally quite like, but I don't know that it is, again, such a game-changing difference, is the media playback box now just looks a lot different. It presents info in a more aesthetic way. You've got also more options. You've got the progress bar now that allows you to drag and you know, what's the word when you're skipping along a track
scrub?
But you're not a thank you scrub the timeline sort of the media, and it squiggles, you know, there's a little animation that it's like waving along with the tune, so
yeah.
That's kind of nice. It looks nicer and you've got a few more functions. So I actually kind of like it. But this is, I think, barely scratching the surface of what we're going to see in actual Android 13. So for now, I mean, I always have to warn people, if you want to download and install beta software, you better be the sort of person that has a spare phone, because this is not going to be very stable. I haven't encountered any real issues, but I've read about a lot of people for whom this beta has been, like, just not working, killing their apps.
And we're not expecting, you know, a full official release until the fall. So it's, you know, we're looking at, you know, 4 or 5 months of, you know, tuning, and, you know, there's going to be more updates. So once again, this is not the final build of Android, you know, just kind of getting a preview of it for, you know, now that the public beta is available.
And also interesting timing, because what is it, like, in 2 weeks, we'll get Google I.O., where we're expecting to hear more about Android 13, at the very least, like, big things coming to Android 13. But hey, segue alert,
yeah.
We're also potentially going to see Google's long-awaited, long-heralded Pixel Watch. We've heard about this, God, like, years and years now, Sam. I feel like when I was at my last job, I heard about a Pixel Watch.
Yeah, this has been the most long-awaited thing. It's nice to, like, finally see some signs that it's like, oh, it
yes.
might actually arrive and maybe mm-hmm. won't be too far from now, hopefully.
The rumor mill is kind of conflicted on the timing. Some people are thinking it's going to be at I.O. Some people are thinking, no, maybe they're going to save it for later in the year, so fall event. Here's what has happened, though, right? We've seen that Google has trademarked the name Pixel Watch fairly recently. And also, someone, as if it's 2008 or something, left a prototype of the Google Pixel Watch at a restaurant.
Yep.
And a bartender picked it up or something, held onto it for something like 4 weeks, and then, yeah, hit up Android Police Authority, an Android blog, and was like, here you go, we have pictures of this thing, we found it. So that's another indication that this is real and coming. We just don't exactly know officially when yet. Sam, does this make you laugh? I just feel like...
I mean, okay, so as a former Gizmodo employee who got in big trouble back in the day for, you know, someone found an iPhone 4 at a bar and the EIC of Gizmodo bought it and then tried to just, you know, ran some stories about it and then tried to bargain with Steve Jobs about, and Steve Jobs obviously very wanted it back and we didn't, Gizmodo didn't really want to give it back and then they eventually did, but that, you know... It was a whole saga. I mean, I don't think, you know, whoever found it this time tried to, like, barter with Sundar Pichai for, like, you know, return of the Pixel Watch. But it's, you know, it's just silly how, like, you know, all these companies talk so much about security. But, like, you know, if someone's out testing a device and they just forget it, like, now it's just in the wild.
I have two stories to add. One is that in direct response to that, Sam, I can't say how I know this, but I feel like a lot of people at Google are like allowed to test these things out and then just kind of like walk around with them, right? So yeah, that security question is like, who are they trusting to have one of these for testing? And then how stringent are they being with measures? I know like when I used to test like something like Fitbit devices before embargo, Fitbit would even supply me with like a little wrist case, strap.
Right, so to like disguise the upcoming device. I mean, it's always hard, right? Because, you know, at some point you do have to take these things out. Because like a smartwatch, you got to test battery life.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to wear it for more than you're at the office. Or, you know, you want to test like sleep tracking features or activity features. You know, these are things that you kind of need to bring them outside of, you know, that the Google campus to really get a sense of. And so, you know, usually like you said, we don't really start to hear about these things until it gets closer to release. So that, you know, is kind of a good sign that like maybe we'll see it at I/O, but at least definitely something this year.
Right. It's definitely like branched outside of the like upper echelon that maybe like Sundar was the first one to test it. And then like now they're seeding it to like, you know, less senior employees to be able to do that. My last thing about this is just, yeah, you're right, Sam, when you brought up that Gizmodo story. We, at Engadget, I think it was the Pixel 5 or something, where we came across a seller in Hong Kong that was just, that had received units early and was just selling them before the fall event, just like, here you go, have at it. And I don't know, so we didn't end up actually paying for this unit. We didn't buy it. We had like our reporter who's based in Hong Kong went and shot video of it and like took photos and did a sort of hands-on. So yeah, there's a lot of points of failure for things that, like this to happen. And I guess we might see the Pixel Watch at I/O soon. Now, for the last thing, I think in our other news segment, second last thing, I saw a Fitcher smart workout mirror last week, and the article actually published this week on Tuesday, I believe. Basically, it's a smart workout mirror. It's a 43-inch screen embedded into like a long looking glass, and you can look at yourself while you work out. But also, it will use a camera that's embedded in sort of the bottom half of the screen to count your reps, monitor your form, that sort of thing. So, I mean, I've become sort of like a fitness enthusiast.
Is your technique getting better? Are you like,
God, my form is your form so on point?
Okay. Are you doing the like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 negative, like making sure to like do the full positive and negative range of motion?
I mean, I try to. So I used to do a lot of this on my own. I spent like the whole of last year really doing this on my own. And then now I've just joined a new gym thing. It's like I'll talk about it another time, but the trainers there are very much like, these are the sets that you have to do, and they involve the full range of motion, and there's a lot going on. But I feel like if you have time, go check out the video on Engadget's YouTube, and you can tell me if my form is good or not. How are my guns? Well, not actual guns, but you know, how are my buys and tries on delts? I think they're pretty okay. And then for the last thing in the other news section this week, Sam.
Yes.
I have a surprise question for you.
I saw that. Now I'm worried.
Sam, tell me how you feel about Motorola's endless rehash of phones.
Ah, right. Okay. So, Yes. So last week, I published an op-ed talking about how I just feel like Motorola needs to slow down. They're just releasing too many phones. And the thing about it is that, like, releasing a lot of phones is one thing if they're all very different. But a lot of Motorola's recent releases are incredibly similar. You know, I noted that in the piece that, like, Moto, they came out with a Moto 5, a Moto G, a new Moto G. And then they came out with a Moto G 5G, which is, like, pretty close to, not exactly the same phone, slightly different, but it's like they come out with one phone without 5G and just so they can release another one that's very similar with 5G like 4 or 5 months later. And then, like, you know, just recently they released the second Moto Stylus 5G in like less than 6 months. And it's just like, and to me the big problem is, like, you know, Motorola is the third biggest smartphone maker in the US, and so, like, even more than Google. And so, like, I feel like they really need to focus on just really building a quality product. And I think part of it is, if you look at, like, LG exiting the cell phone business, I think Motorola was able to scoop up a lot of that market share. And they're like, oh, let's just flood the market and, like, let's try to get as many short-term sales as possible. And that's nice from, like, a business perspective, but, like, I think it really stands the chance of, you know, rubbing the consumer raw. And it's like they feel just like they've been inundated with too many things. And then on top of that, I'm really concerned about Motorola's, like, software support, because as a company policy, Motorola is only doing one major Android update for the G series. And maybe you get 2 years of security updates, sometimes not even that. And even on the flagship, like the Moto Edge Plus that I reviewed recently, you're getting 2 years of software updates, which is, like, not even close to the 3 years that Google is doing for the Pixel 5 series, or the 4 years that Samsung is doing for their phones, or Apple, which is, like, you know, has long been the best in the game when it comes to supporting old devices.
Right. I think not only is this kind of, like, confusing for the user, it's also, it feels to me anyway, like it's incredibly wasteful. The idea of, like, update cycles being shorter, I think, was something that when OnePlus started doing the T version of their flagships, they were like, oh yeah, why can't we be quicker and stuff? I was just like, well, isn't it kind of wasteful? Like, is the idea that someone needs to update their phone every 6 months? I don't think that's necessarily the idea. But if you put out a better phone just 6 months after you just released your, like, so-called best phone of the year, there are people there out there that's going to be like, oh, maybe that's the phone I want now. And they're going to consider upgrading. And then you also, like we were talking about the confusion, you're introducing a lot of, like, uncertainty around when someone should make that purchasing decision. Like, when should they go to their local carrier and be like, I want the next Motorola phone. Not that I think anyone really out there is clamoring for a Motorola.
I mean, but, like, and then to your point, it's like some of the phones, the Moto phones that people are, like, the most interesting Moto phones, like the foldable Razr, that hasn't been updated in a while. Meanwhile, Samsung is, like, you know, they're not flooding the market at all, but, like, they're coming out with regular updates that have noticeable improvements. And so it's like, you know, it's weird to see Moto flood the market on the low end, and then on the high end, like the Moto Edge Plus, I still maintain that it's wildly overpriced. And then we haven't gotten like a real update to the Razr in a year and a half, and it's like, what's going on?
We've got people in the YouTube live chat here, like Danny Leong, who agree, who, like, say that Moto's releases are confusing. We've got Bryant Mitchell asking a very good important question: why does the Moto Stylus even exist?
I mean, I'm not upset at the Moto Stylus existing, because I think it's nice to have, you know, a phone that has stylus support that's not made by Samsung. That's fine. Yeah. But, like, you know, you have to add features. You can't just be like, let's add 5G. And by the way, not millimeter wave 5G, just sub 6 5G, and then slap a 5G tag on it and call it a day. And it's like, that, it's really frustrating. And then, you know, there are even smaller issues, like the most recent Moto G 5G, which is incredibly annoying to say, doesn't have an NFC chip on it. So if you want to use stuff like Google Pay, you just can't. And then if you move up slightly, you know, pay a little bit more for the Moto G Stylus 5G, that one does have NFC. But it's like, you know, why? NFC should be a basic feature on every phone. Like, that's kind of non-negotiable at this point, as far as I'm concerned.
Any sort of contactless payment method, I think, needs to be, like, basically expected, if not mandatory at this point. Quick shout out then to also, like, dude named Charlie who was saying that, yeah, the Motorola phone names themselves are confusing. And you're exactly right when you said Moto G, 5G. What is that? Like a TikTok dance of a name. It's like different steps to like a thing. I don't even... Moto... We rant about companies a bunch, right? We talked about how Samsung has made too many phones, and I think they've taken heed. You had a really good op-ed about OnePlus fairly recently where they're just not the company that, you know, people mm-hmm. might have loved from the start anymore. And now we've got Moto. I think we're seeing a trend in Android phone makers not really understanding what to do moving forward and trying to, in such a mature market, still trying to do things differently. And you know, then we've got poor sad stories like poor LG saying goodbye. It's a really interesting time.
People are holding on to their phones longer than they have before. Gosh, yeah. So it's like even more important to like not kind of try to like piecemeal your consumers. You want everyone to like when they get a new device, they want to feel like, you know, they got their money's worth. And when, you know, there's a new phone coming out every 3 months, you don't really get that same sensation.
Well, we'll keep an eye out on, obviously, the Android market. I'm sure we'll see more rants coming from you, Sam. I love when you go on a phone company rant, and it's one of the best things ever. But yeah, no, if you're out there rocking a Moto phone and you're like a big fan of Motorola, hey, send us an email at podcast@engadget.com with your thoughts. I'd love to hear why, actually. So let's move on to what we're working on this week. Sam, tell me all about your workload.
There's, you know, a lot of laptops coming out. So mm-hmm. I have the Razer Blade 15. I'm working on that review. You know, they haven't changed much with the design, but new internals, new GPU, new CPU, always nice. And then Dell just announced that the XPS 13 Plus is on sale today, I believe. So we're looking to get that in shortly. Not sure who exactly is going to be doing that review, but, you know, any change to the XPS 13, which has been like the best Windows mm-hmm. laptop for a decade, is mm-hmm. always going to be big news. Mm-hmm. And I also have Lenovo's flagship Yoga system. So, you know, hopefully to be taking a look at that. And then, you know, before we know it, Google I/O is going to be here, and that's going to be a whole nother thing. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, Sam, you're doing a lot, I'm just going to say. Thank you for doing so much hard work.
What are you working on in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like we just published that Fitness Mirror hands-on. I am also working on the Android 13 beta. That should be up today, tomorrow, so you can check it out on Engadget.com or the YouTube channel. And then some secrets that I can't really talk about for a little bit. Also, earnings season. We're in the thick of it. I've got Apple's earnings later today to cover. I'm very depressed at the stock market.
You know, we're not like a, you know, financial outlet, but I think it's like a lot of people are looking to the Apple earnings to be like, oh, if Apple like misses their predictions, like, are we in a bear market now?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, and that does kind of affect like, you know, the pace of, you know, change and stuff. And it's like, you know, if a lot of the big Fang or Manga or however you want to like label them, companies like are just kind of having like an off, you know, off earnings, you know, that can affect, you know, what those companies release as far as like, you know, consumer products down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. No, if they have an off quarter, who knows how it'll impact their product line. So we're paying attention to that too. And then like Sam said, we've got Google I/O coming up. We've also got a flurry of activity around the week of May 10th, May 9th. We've got all kinds of summits. We've got all kinds of events. So I'm just pre-stressing out about all of that. But around Engadget, we've got other stories from our team that we want to highlight as per usual. Our editor-in-chief, Dana Wollman, just published her guide to the best wireless workout headphones that you can buy. So check it out. Dana is a marathoner. She is also like a running coach. Her advice, I would take. Dan Cooper wrote about Spotify's earnings, which I kind of just talked about as earnings season. But Dan had like a really great take on it, which is that Spotify still grew despite the Joe Rogan boycotts and the closures in Russia. So What's Spotify doing right? I don't know. We've talked about Spotify on this show before. We're not going to give them too much more time. Steve Dent also reviewed the Panasonic Lumix GH6 for us. This is basically like a vlogging workhorse, he said. It doesn't have face detect autofocus still, which seems odd to me for a camera in 2022.
Panasonic has been a little slower to adopt face detection compared to some of the other companies. And it works out for them, but like, yeah, it's you kind of wish it was there.
Yeah, it doesn't really impact too much. I think for images, it's still, or was it for video? For images, it was still okay. But Steve gets into all of that nitty gritty. You can check out his review. All right, Sam, I see we were just talking a little bit about, you know, what if Twitter saga here became a movie, right? But we've also seen a whole vein of like tech startup movies or shows recently. We got We Crashed, we got The Dropout. I was watching Inventing Anna, which is not tech, but it is similar, like a based on real events sort of story. I've loved those shows. But what would you tell people to watch if they were trying to take a break from all of that?
Okay, so not tech startup related. Mm-hmm. I think I just finished The Foundation on Apple TV Plus. Like for me, sci-fi is like my main jam. I'm always on the lookout for new sci-fi stuff. And weird, like you know, I read a ton of sci-fi too. And for some reason, The Foundation's trilogy is the one that I just never missed. I just kind of missed growing up. And so I was able to go into it without having any like preconceptions or prior knowledge. And I thought it was pretty good. Obviously, it's tough to adapt a series as big as Foundation, but I think they did a really good job. And I really like Lee Pace as like the Emperor. I think he did an incredible job. And the actress who played Salvar Hardin was really, really good. And I'm not sure I've seen her in anything before. And I really liked her performance as well. But it's like, it's a very like heady thing because you're talking about like, you know, a trilogy that spans like hundreds of years and like has an emperor that has like a genetic dynasty, which is like just a really like in crazy concept to think about.
I've seen it on Apple TV Plus. I don't know if I haven't ever watched it. I don't know if the series, the novels as well, but what is this? This looks more like a fantasy series than it is hard sci-fi.
It's very sci-fi. There's a little bit of fantasy, but it's like, basically, the premise is that there is a empire that has been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and it's led by this genetic dynasty, which has one guy who has cloned himself. So it's three people, and there's like a day and a night and like a dusk or morning, day, and dusk versions of each person. So there's one person who's like a kid, there's one person who is like an adult, like midlife, and there's an older version, and they like come together to make this like joint empire, and they are in control. And then there's, you know, a new guy, and so the big conflict is that one guy kind of predicts that the empire is going to fall, and obviously the empire does not like this. And it kind of, and this is like, they haven't even dived into like the whole saga yet. But like they're kind of exploring, it's like how do you govern an empire that spans thousands of light years, thousands of years time wise, and it's just like I kind of like that, you know, philosophical kind of thinking about it as it applies to science fiction and, you know, future.
I might give it a watch. Dang. Okay. Are you done with Foundation? Are you moving on to a new series?
Oh yes. So I just finished Foundation. That was great. You have too many surprises for me. And I think I'm trying to decide what I move on to next. And I think right now I kind of decided on Peacemaker. I've heard mm-hmm. a lot of good things. Mm-hmm. I liked the Suicide Squad, the most recent Suicide Squad movie. And I actually think Peacemaker is a great role for John Cena, who has like, you know, long kind of like been dancing around with his acting jobs and has made a lot of cameos and other stuff and has been in movies before. But I think this role is like really perfectly suited to like his acting range and demeanor and all that. And, you know, I think it'll be good. So I haven't started it yet, but maybe this weekend.
It's out there. It's, I don't know if it's raunchy is the right word, but I enjoyed it too. I'm sure you guys will too. For me, I have a lot of things I could talk about, but this weekend, I think, I finally watched A Quiet Place Part 2, which has been out, I think, for a while. I just finally got around to watching it. And it, as a sequel, it is, I liked it a lot. It's, you know, in the first one, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but one of the characters doesn't make it. They show up for a part of this and like sort of flashbacky stuff. But then, you know, I thought that without that character, this show would lose some of its heart, but it really doesn't. I think they've managed to move the story forward. As you know, those of you who are not familiar with the show, the original premise is that this, you know, the world has been invaded by these alien creatures that have heightened sense of hearing. And so now the whole world is just quiet. The protagonists of the story are a family with a child that has a hearing aid. And so they all have some form of understanding of sign language. And they're able to communicate with sign language as well. And it's just such a great premise, because like, it's, everything's quiet, every little bit of sound will like just scare you to death. And this show has just a lot more, the sequel has a lot more characters that move the story a lot forward. I like, is Cillian Murphy or Cillian Murphy, how do you
think
pronounce
it's Cillian
that? Yeah, I don't know, but Cillian's with a C, Murphy is in it too. He does a really great job. For the first half of the show, I was like, is he Benedict Cumberbatch, like what's going on here?
But well, then okay, hold on. Hold on. Dude, those two people do not look any...
I know. I realize this, but for, he's very bearded and has a cap on like for the first half of the show. So for I like didn't look at the cast list before I started streaming. So I was like, who the hell? This is a familiar person. And yeah, no, it's Cillian Murphy. But this brings to mind, like, I don't know, one of the first horror movies that terrified me was Tremors. Sam, have you ever seen Tremors?
Okay. I didn't think you were going to go there. I love Tremors because Tremors it's like so a great B movie. I'm not mm-hmm. like, I know you're like a huge horror film buff. I like that movie just because it's like weird and like kind of like low quality, but like, I think the performances are really good. Like Kevin Bacon is actually crushes yeah. in that movie. And it's like the monsters in that movie are so silly, but like, it's actually like kind of like a horror comedy to me. And
right, right.
Tremors is like one of my like favorite, like all time great cult hit, like B movies.
Yeah.
I was, yeah. Fantastic.
I know it's surprising.
But I recommend it to everybody. Yeah. Everyone go watch Tremors.
Everyone should watch Tremors. The reason I bring it up is because when I watched Tremors, I think I was a kid. I was like maybe 10, 11. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. But then I missed all of the like nuanced acting stuff, right? It was really the idea of the monster that like stayed with me. And so I think for like weeks I had the Jaws effect where like I couldn't walk on the ground unless like, you know, I was like, oh no, they'll hear my footsteps.
Yeah. Playing AQP, Flora's Lava.
Exactly. Basically, Floor is Lava for my life after I watched Tremors. But A Quiet Place has that sort of sensation where you're like immersed in this world so much that it stays with you afterwards and you kind of want to remain silent. So anyway, if you're interested in that sort of environment, or you know, you're feeling something a little less upbeat this weekend, I guess, you can check out A Quiet Place too. Well, that's it for this episode, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Sam online at
Sam Rutherford, or obviously on Engadget.com.
Yeah, if you need to tell me all the reasons to get off of Twitter, I'm at Sherlinlo on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on your podcast catcher of choice.